missing, but are miscategorized. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent Colin Campbell, who's with us from Washington. Colin, what do these numbers mean?
Well, these numbers mean that they are not really dedicated to understanding just how deleterious police involvements are when it comes to shootings and its impact on the black community and communities of color, as we see that there are disproportionate ways that communities of color are affected by police shootings. Now, of course, this is not a new conversation. This is something that has been discussed for decades, but still we haven't seen that will coming from politicians or from the police to really track these shootings more accurately. What does that do? Well, that sets in place white hegemony, that power struggle that whites have struggled and wanted to maintain throughout decades since the founding of this country. And they do it using the police force. And then we see that it goes to another level on the stretch or the lengths of fatalities that black people and communities of color suffer at the hands of police. And so what there needs to be is reform to how these records are being collected, the reports that are being made, and the repercussions that happen when there is a police shooting and someone dies, and it's very unclear whether or not that shooting was necessary. The high-profile cases, we do hear about those, like George Floyd, not a shooting, but still a police killing. But there are so many other shootings that happen across the country that go unreported, that don't get the media spectacle that other cases do. And these still leave behind shattered lives, families, friends, brothers, sisters, you name it. These people are all victims of police shootings, and then their families are also victimized as well. So this really has to be taken a lot more seriously, something that hasn't been done in the history of the U.S., and it's just now being revealed. I would suppose that there are going to be advocacy groups that will really try to campaign to the president to take a stand on this, whether or not it's something that he has his Justice Department adjust, at least federally, and then hopefully it trickles down to states and then local municipalities. But something needs to be done as of yesterday, in fact.
All right, thanks a lot, Colin Campbell, joining us from Washington, D.C. Our guests joining us on tonight's Spotlight are former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Professor of African American Studies at University of Houston, Gerald Horn, who's with us from Houston, Texas. Well, let's start off with Mr. Horn in Houston. Welcome to the program here on Press TV Spotlight. This report found that between 1980 and 2018, more than 55% of deaths from police violence, that's over 17,000 in total, were either misclassified or went unreported. Plain and simple, is this a cover-up?
It is a cover-up. It's a tragedy. It's also a crime against humanity. As you may know, the black community through our organizations have been clamoring for a United Nations human rights investigation of this quasi-genocidal pattern that has been inflicted upon the black community. And I urge and encourage the international community to move with all due deliberate speed to intervene, because what's going on cannot be allowed to continue. You should also know that in today's newspapers, there was another stunning article about the fact that as of 2020 alone, there were thousands, 70,000 cases of missing black girls, girls under the age of 18. Where have they gone? Where have they disappeared to? At the same time, black children only are 14% of the nation's children population, but they're 31% of the children that are missing. What's going on in the United States is obviously an outgrowth of slavery. It's obviously an outgrowth of the unresolved issues that followed slavery, speaking of the hated apartheid system known as Jim Crow. And you should know that that system only began to retreat because of international pressure. And I dare say that today's tragedies will likewise only retreat under unremitting international pressure.
Matthew Fogg in Washington, D.C., do you agree with Mr. Horn? This is an effort to conceal the truth. Even so, the figures are still too high anyways, aren't they?
Oh, the figures are staggering. I mean, when you look at the numbers of the percentage of African Americans that live in the United States, and you're talking about the numbers, the disproportionate numbers of those that are missing or having some type of a negative impact in their life, it's crazy. I mean, yes, I agree 100%. Until this country recognizes that it has a racial issue that is perpetuated from slavery and all the way back, and that the country is still very much divided on this issue, we're going to have problems. It's definitely in law enforcement, that's for sure.
Let's go back to Mr. Horn. The study, it discovers that Black Americans are 3.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white Americans, and Hispanic people are killed at a ratio of 1.8 times higher than non-Hispanic white people. The review of data shows that many fatal police encounters are misclassified, but often most often when the victim is Black or Hispanic. Again, the minorities here bear the brunt of all this. Tell us more, please.
Well, it's interesting. The study that you mentioned references killings by the police. But keep in mind, there are other cases that even this study, as significant and profound as it is, did not encompass. Recall that just a few years ago, not far from where I'm sitting in Houston, Texas, there was the case of the young Black woman, Sandra Bland, who was pulled over by the police because of a traffic violation, was taken to jail, and apparently was so harassed and so traumatized by being in prison that she hung herself. So that would be classified as a suicide, although it's fair to say that the proximate cause of her death was her maltreatment and mistreatment by the police. You should also know that just recently in the U.S. Congress in Washington, D.C., there was an attempt to pass a change in the law, the so-called George Floyd Policing Act. You referenced George Floyd, the Black man in May 2020 in Minnesota, who was killed on camera at the hands, or I should say at the knee, on the neck, administered by a Minnesota police officer. But what's striking is that the Republican Party, the opposition party, did not negotiate in good faith. They basically claimed in a demagogic fashion that if the federal government wants to hold back funds to police departments that use chokeholds, which is an illegal way to restrain a potential suspect, which oftentimes leads to that suspect's death, or if the police department continues to use no-knock warrants, that's when the police don't knock on the door. They just come through your door without knocking and start shooting anybody who resists. The Republicans claim that if you try to restrain and cut off funds from police departments who use such crazy tactics, that that's something that will not go down well with them. And so the bill died. And so presumably, police departments are still authorized in many cities to use chokeholds, to use no-knock warrants, and this will continue to cause an escalation and rise of the deaths of citizens, particularly Black American citizens.
Matthew Fogg, past studies have analyzed underreporting of fatal police incidents and how Black Americans disproportionately die from police violence, but those previous researches, they were conducted over much shorter time periods. This report, it covered 40 years. Do you believe that the manner of conduct has been the same basically for decades?
Well, I've been in law enforcement for 30 years. I've also been a police expert on law enforcement race issues for about 20 years. I've won a major case against the U.S. Department of Justice myself, fighting racism internally behind the blue wall of silence. I've been there. I've seen how officers can conduct themselves in ways that certainly is not part of our training, but it becomes a culture once you get on the job. And the problem is within law enforcement, and yes, the report is 100% hitting on. I mean, this goes way back. Like I said, for all of the years that I've been in the U.S. Marshals and was a member in law enforcement, worked with dragnet operations all over the country, I had a chance to actually see it in place. And I'm with an organization like right behind me called Blacks in Government, and I'm also was the front page of a news article on my other side that says Bigots with Badges, which is my book that's coming out. But the bottom line is this. Racism is infiltrated. The FBI came out and did a report and indicated how many of these subversive, these very, we'll call right-wing racist groups have infiltrated law enforcement. So it is a problem in America. It goes all the way back to the Hoover administration, back when Hoover over the FBI. I mean, we know that law enforcement has been a tool that has been used to actually, as Chief Justice Warren said, who's now deceased, he said the police officer is more powerful than the President of the United States because they have a right to forfeit a person's freedom, their property, or their life at any given time, according on what they perceive their discretion. So this is a problem, and it's a problem that we have to address in America. I've tried to do it with my job. I didn't become one of those police officers that waited until I retired, but I took on the system right when I was there and actually saw these things that we're talking about now, the chokeholds and you know, what happened with George Floyd. And we go even New York City Police Department, when the mayor de Blasio spoke out about telling his black sons to be careful, and the whole half the police department turned their backs on him. So it is a problem in America, and I think right now, with the whole issue of Black Lives Matter, these reports that are coming out, it's saying that this is just not conjured up stuff, but this is real, and we're going to have to figure out a way to deal with it, whether it's in Congress or whether it's marching, but it's got to be dealt with.
Mr. Horn, the study brings forth a grim reality here. Despite years of scrutiny, criticism, protests, calls for reform, no government agency tracks how often law enforcement officers in America kill people. Now, if that's the case, how can anyone ever follow up on these findings or pursue a path that leads somewhere in terms of making a change?
Well, that's a very good question. However, your audience should know that The Guardian, the London-based newspaper, interestingly enough, has been trying to keep statistics and figures on how many people are killed by the police in the United States of America, because obviously there are authorities in the United States of America that are not interested in collecting such data, because I assume they feel that it would be indicting them. Also, the Washington Post in the United States of America has tried as well to keep such figures. But to follow up on what your guest said, studies have shown that in Los Angeles, the second largest metropolis in the United States of America, in the sheriff's department, you have right-wing gangs that prey upon black men in particular, and even have certain kinds of games that they play to show that they have basically harassed or otherwise intimidated or worse, injured or maimed black men in particular. Obviously, this is a cofactor on the skyrocketing incarceration rates of black men in particular, although the rates for black women also are escalating sharply. The United States probably imprisons a higher percentage of its population than any other nation on planet Earth. And then there's the death penalty. Black people are more likely to be subjected to the death penalty, subjected to execution by the state, and they're more likely to be executed if they kill a white person than if they kill a person who's not defined as white. Now, obviously, this is outrageous. It should not be allowed to stand. But once again, I think that we'll need pressure from the international community in order for this system of inequality, this staggering crime against humanity, to somehow cease.
Matthew Fogg, let's talk about it. Mr. Horn just mentioned the issue of the judicial system. Let's talk about the much-seen police impunity in black deaths. As seen time and time again, the judicial system is mostly in favor of the police, especially if the police are white, the victims are of a community of color. Why is this common practice in U.S. courts?
Well, it just shows how systemic racism is. I mean, it just shows you that across the board. I mean, again, I challenge the U.S. Department of Justice, most powerful law enforcement probably organization in the world, because we as U.S. Marshals work under them. I challenged it for race discrimination. In 1998, I got a landmark verdict that said racism was systemic within the U.S. Marshals, and today I'm the class agent representing over 1,500 black U.S. Marshals, the same type of thing that is going on today. So what we say, if it's happening internally, If I got to deal with a bigot with a badge working next to me, imagine what they're going to do to the public. So reality of it is that, yes, the court systems, everybody's in on it. And the reality of it is that until it becomes an issue in America where we start to address it, start to talk about it, it somewhat came out once this past administration, and we started having Black Lives Matter and people started marching in the street. Then all of a sudden, that's where the George Floyd Protection Act came out. Now, the organization I'm with, Blacks in Government, we actually did a resolution, and we passed that resolution telling Congress we supported the George Floyd Protection Act. But it's so much more, because what has happened is we're now beginning to see how entrenched America is on these issues. And as these reports come out, people are now asking the question, well, how can this be in America when we're supposed to be a land that says we're the country of the free? We have to address the fact that in law enforcement, like I said, I'm an expert on the inside. I know what we do. And what I'm saying is, and the culture is such that when you speak up, you become a whistleblower. Actually, you become the bad guy. Once you start speaking up and saying, this has got to stop, it's got to end. We did the same thing with the war on drugs. We took the war on drugs and we built one of the largest prison industrial complexes the world has ever seen, but mainly on the backs of African Americans. When I started noticing that, I brought that up to my managers. I said, listen, we're gonna stop going in the urban areas and making arrests. We're going to start going into some of these more affluent areas, these white areas, these areas where the most drugs and the best stuff comes from. He said, Frog, if you go into those locations and you do that, he said, what's going to happen? They're going to have pushback. They're going to contact their congressman, their lawyer, their judge, whoever. He said, and then next thing you know, they're going to shut our operation down. So we have to understand it is internally. There are a lot of police officers, a lot of people recognize it. We see it. You don't have to wait for a report. You can actually see the studies, and you can look around you and see who actually goes to prison for these crimes and who don't, who gets a break or whatever, a privilege we call it in America. So it is a problem.
All right, Gerald Horn. Researchers, they identified places where misclassification of the deaths often occurred, noting that medical examiners or coroners who must fill out the cause of death when there's suspicion of foul play, including police violence, they can be embedded in or work for the police departments. Now, if the medical examiner, a coroner, or other certifier fails to indicate police involvement in the cause of death on the death certificate, the incident, it could be misclassified. How concerning are these findings?
Well, it's extremely concerning. And what you just mentioned points to a structural problem, a structural flaw in the criminal justice system. It's not only that the coroners and the medical examiners oftentimes work hand in glove with the police departments. These are their comrades, these are their colleagues, and they're very unlikely to present data that might be indicting of their comrades and colleagues. The same holds true for the prosecuting authorities. That is to say, prosecuting authorities are reluctant to bring criminal cases against police officers who break the law, because they too work hand in glove. They too see the police officers as their comrades and colleagues. And then you turn to the law itself. Right now, in many jurisdictions in the United States of America, you have this regulation or law called qualified immunity. What that means is that a police officer, generally speaking, can kill, steal, or rape and not necessarily be found liable if someone wants to sue them for damages. It's also unlikely, I'm afraid to say, for them to be found guilty of a crime because of the structure of the law. Once again, we can't begin to understand this outrage unless you understand the system of slavery, unless you begin to understand that system, which basically equated Black people with being akin to horses, mules, and cattle, not part of the human family. And to this very day, there's that lingering idea that Black people were not part of the human family. And since there has not been a sufficient interrogation, not to mention excoriation, of that particular canard, that lie, okay, that outrage, the system continues to persist.
And one quick question, get a final thought from Matthew Fogg. We were talking about the issue of medical examiners and coroners. The practices are showing that racism is occurring not just during the encounter itself, but even after the individual has passed away. Does this show how deeply embedded systemic racism is in different aspects of American life, most notably in issues pertaining to health?
Well, if someone said it's walking, breathing, driving while black, and death while black. And yes, I mean, the reality of it is that the country has not relinquished its past, and it continues to hold on to that past and the remnants of the past. And like I said, being in law enforcement, having been on the front lines, and having been wanting to be a part of an organization that would say equal justice. But when you're talking about racism in America, I mean, it's just not there. And we as black law enforcement officers and other officers who recognize it, we owe an oath and a duty to this country and a service to okay. this country to stand up and report it. But yes, you are correct. The disparities are there 100% in just about okay. everything.
Thanks a lot. That's all the time we have. Allow me to thank my guests, former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg, joining us from Washington, D.C. Also thanks to Professor of African American Studies at University of Houston, Mr. Gerald Thorne, joining us from Houston, Texas. Also special thanks to you, our guests, for staying with us on this issue of Spotlight. It's good night for now and bye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. Allah has not taken any son, nor has there ever been with him any deity. If there had been, then each deity would have taken what it created, and some of them would have sought to overcome others. Exalted is Allah above what they describe concerning him.
The 91st verse of the chapter says, مَتَّخَذَ اللَّهُ مِنْ وَلَدٍ وَمَا كَانَ مَعْهُ مِنْ إِلَهِ. No son has Allah begot, nor there is any God along with him. إِذَنْ لَذَهَبَ كُلُّ إِلَهٍ بِمَا خَلَقٍ. Else, each God would have certainly taken off that which he had created. وَلَعَلَى بَعْضُهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ. And some of them would certainly have risen up over others. Subhanallahi amma yasifun. Glorified be Allah above what they describe. Dear listeners, in the previous verses, the subject of resurrection and Almighty Allah's ownership, sovereignty and lordship, and also monotheism were discussed. Now, this verse under discussion criticizes the ideological base of polytheism and state some of the deviations of the polytheists with their responses. You may remember some of the responses of the polytheists upon the questions that they were asked, and the fact that they confessed that the owner is the Almighty Allah, and unto Allah we shall return, but it was hard for them to accept resurrection since it was in contrast with their materialistic approach. Now, the verse says, مَتَّخَذَ اللَّهُ مِنْ وَلَدٍ وَمَا كَانَ مَعَهُ مِنْ إِلَهٍ. No son has Allah begot, nor there is any God along with him. The belief that Allah had begotten an offspring or some children was not limited to the Christians. The Christians held that Jesus was God's actual son. But this belief was also current among some polytheists as well. They thought that the angels were God's daughters, and there is evidence to assume that perhaps the Christians had taken this concept from old polytheists. Since offspring share in the nature of their parents, they assumed that Jesus, the angels, and the like also shared in the divine nature of God, which is one of the most common characteristics of polytheism.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
The verse then mentions the reason why the concept of a plurality of gods should be rejected. The verse is implying that if Allah had had partners and more than one God had ruled over the world,
each of these gods would have managed and established his control over the realm of his own creations. إذن لذهب كل إله بما خلق. Else, each god would have certainly taken off that which he had created. So, at first the verse mentioned that having belief in any kind of offspring for Almighty Allah is forbidden, whether considering Jesus as the Son of Allah or the angels or the others, and now it mentions the consequence of assuming different gods in the world, different gods with different creations. إذن لذهب كل إله بما خلق. Each god would have taken off that which he had created, and different parts of the universe would end up being managed under different laws and different systems. This would have given rise to chaos and disorder in the universe, and this does not accord with the unity of the creation that we witness around us. The Holy Quran says, وَلَعَلَى بَعْضُهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ, and some of them would have certainly risen up over others. And in the end, as a general conclusion, the verse says, Subhanallahi amma yasifun, glorified be Allah above what they describe. So, overall, what we can conclude from this discourse is that we can discern a unified system of laws that governs the world of existence. We can innately understand that these laws are the system everywhere in the heavens and in the earth, and they cannot be created by different gods. Will God willing talk about this verse more in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry, in your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with the reporters.
12-year-old boy, the grandson of Iran's health minister, Bahram Einollahi. Mohammad Sadra received a Sinopharm shot with the presence of the health minister and local media outlets to encourage Iranian families to vaccinate their children with peace of mind.
I urge all families who have children between the ages of 12 and 18 to send their kids for vaccination. This way we can reopen in-person school classes safely in the upcoming months. I brought my grandson today to get the vaccine to prove that vaccines will bear no harm for children.
Iran has so far administered more than 58 doses of COVID vaccines. This means 68% of Iran's population has received at least one shot. This number was less than 10% around 2 months ago, when President Ebrahim Raisi took over power from his predecessor. Iran managed to accelerate the inoculation campaign by speeding up imports of foreign-made jabs, as well as supporting local vaccine developers.
Only in Tehran, more than 10 million people have been fully vaccinated. This is over 70% of the capital's population. The vaccination of lower ages will definitely help us get our kids back to school safely.
Based on the international health guidelines, minus 18 age groups should receive a single dose of COVID vaccine. The Iranian health minister said the country has taken the same approach and will administer one shot to its adolescents. He said once this phase is over, the health ministry will start vaccinating students between 7 and 12 years old.
While Iran lagged behind in the national inoculation program, it has managed to be among the first to inoculate its teenage population. If all goes as planned, children can go back to schools in less than 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinian farmers have held a rally outside the United Nations headquarters in Gaza City to condemn the Israeli ban on the export of their produce to the occupied West Bank and abroad. The Palestinians handed a letter to the representative of the United Nations, also protesting the obstacles and restrictions imposed by the Israeli regime on the international marketing of their crops.
The price of tomatoes is dropping and we are not making any profits. This is because there is no export to the West Bank or any other country. Palestinian farmers are living in hard conditions and have a limited source of income. The Israeli regime forces us to remove the tomatoes covers for exports, and this causes damage before they make it to the markets. We want the borders to open so that we can export our crops, and we demand imports of the required tools for farming.
Palestinian farmers say large quantities of their crops are piled up at Kerm Abu Salem, which is the only gateway out of the Gaza Strip, and are damaged. They say the Israeli regime has imposed impossible conditions on the exports. The Palestinians say they depend on the crops as their only source of income, adding that the regime seeks to destroy their livelihoods.
No crops are allowed to enter other markets. We demand an urgent opening of the borders so our crops can reach the West Bank in the same day they are exported, so the produce get there fresh.
This rally is held to protest the persistent Israeli restrictions on exports of Palestinian crops from Gaza to the West Bank. The impossible conditions that the Israeli regime imposed are aimed at damaging Palestinian crops and preventing the farmers from having a better income. This is a systematic policy to collapse the Palestinian economy and isolate it from the world. Farmers here call on the international community to stop these restrictions. The estimated daily loss for Palestinian farmers is very high.
The Israeli regime keeps imposing restrictions on Palestinian traders and farmers, keeping them from exporting their crops. Palestinian traders and farmers called on the international community to stop these restrictions that led to serious financial losses and dealt a blow to the Palestinian economy. Rubashavit, Gaza.
See a ring of steel and a little army of police think the British Conservative Party. Here in Manchester for their annual conference, with the party leader pitching his Building Back Better mantra yet again. Crashing the party, thousands of protesters from far and wide to tell the Prime Minister he and his clique are not welcome.
There's an array of groups and people who have gathered here today to demonstrate against the Conservative government pretty much everything it stands for, from its domestic policy to foreign policy, from its pandemic response and its position on migrants to its participation in foreign wars and its support for foreign occupation.
And they say examples of the government's failures aren't too difficult to find.
There's a gigantic economic catastrophe threatening the lives of ordinary people. There's a gigantic climate catastrophe threatening the whole planet. There is every reason why we can't trust a government of the rich, for the rich, to deal with these problems.
Another reason that's brought these demonstrators here, the controversial policing bill that gives UK police sweeping powers.
They don't need more powers. They need to be engaging with people in a protective way, not in a way where it's oppressive.
As a result of what critics call conservative government inaction, the UK has experienced one of the highest COVID death tolls in the world, massive economic downturn, a humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, hiking taxes, fuel disruptions, and a rise in Islamophobia and xenophobia in recent years.
I want to make it really clear to the Tories that they're not welcome in this city, that actually their position on fueling racism, targeting refugees, is absolutely disgusting, and therefore we want to make sure that they know just how angry we are.
A decade of conservative rule in the UK has led to a groundswell of public dissatisfaction, which experts say will manifest itself in the 2024 general election. Saeed Puriza, Manchester.
Tears were shed and prayers held in London's Marble Arch, bringing the sights and sounds of Karbala to thousands that gathered there from all over the UK. People from different backgrounds, but all with one thing in common, their love for the Prophet's grandson, who was martyred on the sands of Karbala in the year 680.
This is an extension of the world's largest peaceful procession. And despite the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of people have taken part this year to commemorate Imam Hussein and his family's sacrifice and evoke their message.
Imam Hussein and his family symbolize so many things for those that hold him in their hearts, hope for the oppressed being one of them.
This is the message of Karbala. He did it so that oppression and oppressors could be brought to light. And, people who are innocent, they have hope. So it's a message of hope as well, that you're not alone in this world. There are great personalities, there are people in the world who are ready to fight for you, to die for you.
What Imam Hussein's family went through after his martyrdom is also a focal point of Arbaeen, and the role the women played in the struggle.
We don't need to kind of look to secular role models to kind of take on wholesale this kind of Marxist feminism. We already have women within the family of the Holy Prophet, who had great strength and great dignity. And the important thing is knowledge. This is what we should be as women. We should be people of knowledge. That's the priority.
Every year, this procession highlights events that took place centuries ago, reminding humanity of the ongoing battle against tyranny that we all face today. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Iranian radar system, dubbed Shams, can create simulated electronic warfare scenarios to train fresh military personnel. The system was unveiled together with other defense equipment, all built by the Iranian Army's Air Defense Force.
The fully indigenous Shams system is a long-range radar simulator and allows us to design and execute a range of war scenarios. This way we can enhance the preparedness of our staff members against potential missile attacks and other aerial threats.
Hormuz was another radar system that was put into service on Saturday. It's a medium-range tactical radar capable of detecting and tracking air targets at high, medium, and low altitudes. Iran's Air Defense Force says the new equipment will significantly increase the country's air defense capability.
The major feature of Hormuz radar system is that it can calculate the speed of the target while accurately calculating the distance and sending the data to the fire control systems. I should say that all of the equipment unveiled today and earlier were designed and produced using domestic know-how. We no longer need to import any such equipment from other countries.
Iran has for four decades been under U.S.-led arms embargoes, which prevent the country from purchasing any foreign-made arms. This has over the years prompted the Islamic Republic to try to develop its own weapons to ensure its security. Every year, the country unveils a range of domestically built defense equipment, from UAVs to missiles, as a show of its military might against the backdrop of U.S. sanctions.
The Islamic Republic views U.S. sanctions as a tailwind that has pushed the country toward self-reliance. While these latest military equipment can be counted as a case in point, army officials say this is just the tip of the iceberg, as Iran has indigenized over 80% of its defense arsenal. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Pakistan has lost tens of thousands of its citizens and security personnel since late 2001 when Islamabad joined so-called U.S. war on terror. Pakistan provided the U.S. with its military bases to carry out attacks on Afghanistan and allow the NATO supply line to pass through Pakistan to the neighboring country. But it all backfired with the retaliatory attacks and massive public resentment against the U.S. and successive governments for supporting American imperialistic agenda across the region. After recent humiliating exit of U.S. from Afghanistan and return of Taliban government in Kabul, Islamabad has changed its pro-U.S. policy. Now Pakistan has decided to bring an end to two decades-long violence through negotiation with the different groups working under the umbrella of Pakistani brand of Taliban movement and other groups engaging in insurgency in southwestern Balochistan province.
In fact, I think some of the Pakistani Taliban groups actually want to talk to the to our government, for some peace, for some reconciliation. And we are in talks with some of the groups. I do not believe in military solutions. I'm anti-military solutions. So I always believe that, as a politician, political dialogue is the way ahead.
Before the change of guards in Kabul, Pakistan blamed India to have been using different militant groups from Afghan soil to fan insurgency in its southwestern and northwestern regions bordering with Afghanistan.
The Ashraf Ghani government and other hostile governments in Kabul were providing them conducive conditions to attack Pakistan. But now that the Talibans are there and Talibans have guaranteed or have assured Pakistan that the Afghan land will not be used will not be allowed to be used against Pakistan.
Many militant groups have repeatedly attacked in Pakistan on Beijing's economic and geostrategic interests linked with its global project known as Belt and Road Initiative. The mega project starts from Chinese province Xinjiang and passes through nearly 3,000 kilometer long road network of Pakistan before sailing through Arabian Sea to reach onwards rest of Asia, Africa, and parts of Europe. Both Washington and New Delhi have publicly opposed China's mega project, which has challenged the economic hegemony of the U.S. Now Islamabad wants to win over the terrorist groups through a reconciliation process in an effort to wean them away from the foreign powers, using them to disrupt over $50 billion U.S. dollar investment of China in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
On Friday in the Italian capital, over 3,000 Alitalia workers staged a new protest against the government's decision to shut down Italy's flag carrier since 1947. Alitalia is to be replaced by a slimmed-down state-owned airline called ITA, Italia Trasporto Aereo, that is planned to take over many of its assets. For years, Alitalia workers have held protests trying to block the morphing operation, which base unions say will result in the loss of thousands of jobs.
8,000 jobs will be slashed under the deal. Furthermore, we estimate that three external workers for each sacked Alitalia employee will find themselves unemployed. This is social butchery. Our country should be ashamed. The plan is to take a competitor like Alitalia out to make things easier for Air France, British Airways and Lufthansa.
In practical terms, the government is wiping the national collective agreement off. Workers in the aviation industry will no longer have any protection. They will become on-call employees. It's a shame that our largest left-leaning party and the largest unions have opted to team up with neoliberal forces.
Last month, the EU competition regulators surprisingly approved the morphing of debt-stricken Alitalia into a smaller company, conceding that the new state-owned airline was not liable for repaying 900 million euros in illegal state aid received by its forerunner.
The demand is that we need Alitalia. Italy needs a flag company. That's why we are here. And ITA is not that.
The new ITA airline will operate with less than half of Alitalia's fleet of aircraft. Pilot and aircrew pay is set to be almost halved. ITA is reportedly set to introduce a new labor contract aimed at giving it greater flexibility and competitiveness.
The 74-year-old Italian flag carrier Alitalia is set to fly for the last time on October 15. On the same day, its new incarnation airline, ITA, will start operating with 2,800 employees. More than two-thirds of Alitalia's staff, however, will be laid off. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran's army ground forces on Friday launched a military exercise in the northwestern region close to the borders with Azerbaijan and Armenia. Artillery, drone, and electronic warfare units with aerial support from the Army's Airborne Division are participating in the exercise. The drill is codenamed Conquerors of Khaybar, a reference to the 7th century Battle of Khaybar, in which Prophet Muhammad and his army of early Muslims foiled a plot hatched by Jewish tribes. Iran's army ground forces commander, Brigadier General Qumars Haydari, who is leading the drills, says his country will not tolerate the presence of Israeli elements or terrorists in the region.
We respect the sovereignty of all countries, including our neighbors, but are strongly against the presence of the Zionist regime as well as the Daesh terrorists.
Iran has long voiced concern over what it calls the presence of Israeli elements and terrorists near its northwestern borders. Tehran says the terrorists assembled there at the invitation of a regional state at the height of a 2020 conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Iran particularly accuses Israel of hatching plots in order to sow discord among Muslim nations, saying the regime sees its survival through creating insecurity. Some analysts say the drills send a clear and powerful message to other countries against any acts that challenge Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
This one here in the Northwest is very significant because it's sending out a clear message that Iran is not going to be passive. They're going to proactively be hunting and seeking out any forces which are trying to violate the stability of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And don't forget, it's been done because the Azerbaijani themselves have talked about a southern Azerbaijan, referring to the Iranian territories, which are the province of Azerbaijan, as essentially theirs. Now, this is something the Israelis, I'm sure, can stoke up really quite a lot in terms of trying to create division and fragmentation.
Moreover, General Haydari also made it clear that the Islamic Republic will not tolerate any change to the official borders. He stressed that the transit routes in the region should remain safe and secure, and that all the regional countries should respect the flow of trade and energy through their borders. Last week, Iran's Islamic Revolution's Guard Corps held a separate military exercise in the northwestern province of Ardabil. The drill drew criticism from Azerbaijan's President Ilham Aliyev, who said he was surprised by Iran's decision since it hadn't held maneuvers in the region for about three decades. Iran's foreign ministry, however,
reacted to Aliyev's remarks, saying the drills was meant to secure regional peace and security.
Afghanistan's Deputy Minister of Information and Culture, Zabihullah Mujahid, says the United States has violated the country's airspace by its drones. He accused Washington of violating all international law, as well as a U.S. Taliban peace deal signed between the two sides. He said the violations must be controlled and prevented.
Daesh presence in Afghanistan is not a big headache for us. Our forces are capable to uproot them here without receiving any foreign support. So the U.S. must honor Doha deal and stop violating our space.
Mujahid's statement followed remarks by Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. He said the U.S. retained all necessary authorities to execute over-the-horizon counter-terrorism operations. Kirby also said Washington remains confident in its capabilities moving forward without speaking to specific rules of engagement surrounding airstrikes. He said there is currently no requirement to clear airspace with the Taliban. Analysts say since the U.S. did not fulfill its commitments to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, it is not expected to honor other pacts like U.S.-Taliban Doha deal.
Violating Afghanistan's sovereignty is not a new move by the U.S. It has repeatedly broken its promises, mainly when it comes to respecting our country's sovereignty, even during the rule of former governments here.
Given the U.S. is insisting on continuation of drone strikes in Afghanistan without coordination with the Taliban, the group has also warned the U.S. of negative consequences of continuing violation of Afghanistan's airspace. The U.S. claims that it targets terrorist groups like Daesh with its airstrikes. However, evidence on the ground shows that innocent Afghans are usually the real victims of such attacks. One of the last U.S. drone strikes was in Kabul on August 29 and killed 10 members of a family, including 6 children. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Prophet's Departure, a Day of Profound Grief. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Salam, dear listeners, and heartfelt condolences to you all on a day of grief. In fact, a day of double grief, since today is the doleful 28th of Safar, on which we mourn the end of the mission of Almighty's last messenger to mankind, as well as the martyrdom through poisoning of his elder grandson, exactly on the 39th anniversary of the grandfather's departure from the mortal world. We will present you two exclusive features today. The first, on Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and the second one, on Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him. Stay with us for the feature on the Prophet, whom God has hailed, mercy unto the creation. It is he who sent to the unlettered people the messenger from among themselves to recite to them his signs, to purify them, and to teach them the book and wisdom. And earlier, they had indeed been in manifest error.